Hello and welcome to the Majlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis and Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager here in Washington, D.C. Well, it is happening in Turkmenistan, an election without Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov, which means in months' time there will be a new man in the office after 15 years of his one-man rule. The election is planned for March 12. Interestingly, it was an early election and the nation was given only 1 month to prepare for and hold the ballot. Obviously, there are questions that we would like to unpack on why they decided this way. But from President Berdimuhamedov's point of view, the guy he sees as his successor doesn't need much preparation. He got everything working for him in the country. And he is no other than President's son, Serdar Berdimuhamedov, whom President has been grooming all along for this route. Authorities say that it will be a contested election, so we can expect a few additional names to be thrown in the mix, but there is no doubt which way the wind is blowing. So nevertheless, it's a change, and now the question is what kind of a change it's going to be, what kind of person are we looking at as the next leader, how we got here, what was the urgency behind putting this change in motion, why now, and where are we headed from here. To discuss all these, I'm joined by Ambassador Laura Kennedy, former U.S. Ambassador to Turkmenistan, Dr. Lukan Çiftçi, the author of a book on Turkmenistan's foreign policy and a lecturer at the Glasgow University on Central Asia, Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty Central Asia blog, Kishlok Awazi, and we hope and expect to have Ruslan Matiyev, the director of Turkmen News Portal, to join us in this conversation. So thank you very much, colleagues, for joining us on this important discussion. So this is happening. The power succession. Did anything surprise you the way things turned out or coming together? Let's start with you, Ambassador Kendi.
Mohammed, let me, if I might, actually look backwards a little bit. And that is that in my own experience, of course, when I dealt with Niyazov, you know, you'd often hear the comparisons between Turkmenistan and North Korea, which I would actually dispute in several important regards. I mean, despite the fact that both countries were, you know, highly centralized, autocratic, cut off in many ways from the outside world. But, you know, I thought there were two main things that differentiated it. And that is that one, Turkmenistan didn't threaten its other neighbors as North Korea has so dangerously. And also that Niyazov, for all that he was obviously amassing wealth and power and the levers of control, as we all know, his family never appeared. His estranged wife and daughter were in Moscow. His son was always rumored to be abroad doing something, but never heard of, never referred to, never any sense that he was grooming anyone in the family. And so now, of course, we have a very different situation. And so it remains to be seen how this will happen. I mean, we've seen, I think, other attempted transfers, managed transfers of power. So this is very much a work in progress, I'd say.
Why you say that, Ambassador?
One, there isn't a tradition there. You know, look at Nazarbayev, for example, an immensely powerful, popular, crucial figure in his own country. But perhaps if he had had, you know, sons instead of daughters, maybe he could have carried it off. But I never saw any real chance that Dariga, for example, would be able to succeed him. Uzbekistan, Gulnara certainly was not going to be a real contender to succeed. I mean, in Tajikistan, I mean, Rahmon seems to, you know, have a very much expanded role for his son. But this is not, this would be a first, at least in Central Asia, where you pass on to a family member. So that's why I say it's a work in progress, even though clearly the government, you know, has a scenario mapped out.
I thought, you know, Tajikistan will try this first. But anyway, Turkmenistan kicked off. But let's see, as you say, where we are headed with this. So any other thoughts, Bruce, Dr. Çiftçi, you know, the way things are turning out in Turkmenistan? I thought, you know, he would ultimately, I mean, I'm talking about Serdar here, he would ultimately replace his dad. But the way it is happening, and I thought it might take a while before he will brought to power in this way. But maybe it was planned all along. I don't know. Any other thoughts?
Bruce, do you mind if I jump in here?
No, please, go ahead.
Mohammed, I have to do something which, as academic, we're not well known to do.
Do
I have to admit I have been wrong. I never thought we would get to this point. I mean, of course, in the last few years I have, because I fought Turkmenistan. But if you ask me 5 years ago, shortly after Mirziyoyev became president in Uzbekistan, for instance, are we ever going to see familial transition in Central Asia? I would have said no. And I have published on succession in Central Asia. And all what happened in Turkmenistan is pretty much making me realize that I couldn't read the sign. Obviously, we have had, as you were saying, the regime intending to doing this all along. But to go back to what the ambassador was mentioning before, I think that the last 5 years highlighted what is the most important question in Central Asian politics, that is succession. And we've had different answers to that. We have the Uzbek answer, which was very similar to the Turkmen one, the 2007 transition, where the Kazakh one will turn out to be wrong. And now we have a new attempt. Unfortunately, this attempt is going to be something that is going to bring a lot of trouble to the population, because in this game of the Berdimuhamedov, it is the population that draws the shortest straw. Because to my mind, this is the candidate of continuity, is the candidate of regime preservation, is not the candidate of change, is not the candidate of economic diversification. We're going to see more the same with the president that is younger or the prior one and can be in power and then will be damaging for longer.
Interesting interpretation there. So, Bruce, did you think that it was coming and coming in this way?
Well, I mean, ever since he got elected to Sardar, I mean, ever since he got elected to parliament in a, you know, a snap election that no one even heard of. I mean, the first time we heard that he was elected to parliament was after he was elected to parliament. You know, and the seat that he filled, the candidate suddenly decided to step down right before they had these elections. So, you know, you could start to see this taking shape, you know, more than 5 years ago. Certainly in the last couple of years, you know, it's been pretty obvious. They've been grooming him for the top spot. The only thing that really surprised me about this whole thing was that I kind of figured that there would be a bigger lead up to the actual decision to hold presidential elections. I mean, the Halkmaz-Sahati meeting that they had was very strange because it didn't, you know, one, it wasn't televised, which was really bizarre. Not that probably very many people watched previous Halkmaz-Sahati sessions on TV anyway. And the announcement came like really, really late at night. You know, I mean, it was on a Friday. You would have thought that would have been the centerpiece of the whole thing. You know, news flashed, you know, Berdimuhamedov says it's time to hand over power to a younger generation. And he's looking forward to just being the head of the Halkmaz-Sahati for a while. But, you know, I was watching and watching, you know, late in, up to Friday night. And the announcement still hadn't come when I went to sleep. And it was only the next morning, you know, when all of a sudden there was an official from the Central Election Commission that said, oh, yeah, right, where are we at? Elections, March 12th. You know, and I'm like, wow, what? You know, you would have thought, especially given Berdimuhamedov's character, that there would have been bands playing outside the place and balloons and doves would have been let loose.
Interesting.
And, you know, all kinds of stuff.
Why you think, Bruce, they might have handled this way? I mean, is there any particular reason that you could think of?
You know, there's obviously a lot of things you could speculate about. One, certainly the events in Kazakhstan might have sped this up a little bit. You know, that they did have a period of unrest there, and it was connected with this, ultimately with the succession. You had Nazarbayev supporters that didn't want Tokayev in because it looked like Nazarbayev was, you know, he was getting pretty frail in those last video images we had of him from the very end of last year. So we don't know what President Berdimuhamedov's health is. It's always a question.
So you are talking about the timing, right?
Yeah, as far as the timing, why they might have done it now.
But also unceremonious ways that you are hinting at, the way he announced it, the way he came up with the idea, with lots of ambiguities attached to that, saying it's time for younger generation to take power, but not clearly naming his son or some things like that, and also doing it at late night. So what does that tell you?
This is the one that puzzles me. Well, why not? Everyone knew this was coming, especially the people in Turkmenistan. I mean, it's been obvious for the last few years that this is the way it was going to go. And so why they had to sneak it in, you know, in the early morning on a weekend, too, you know, this would have been something. I would have figured they would have done this on Monday and they would have been celebrating all week. But to do it on Friday and just kind of like slip that news in, you know, early Saturday morning was very strange. I mean, obviously now they've shifted into gear and, you know, the teachers are told to teach their children to praise Serdar Berdimuhamedov as being some great visionary and wise man or something. But like I said, the whole way I would have thought there would have been a lot more pomp and ceremony that preceded the actual announcement that they were going to have elections and that Serdar would run. But maybe he wants, maybe Berdimuhamedov, for whatever reason, President Berdimuhamedov, wants to make this look like it actually is some kind of competition or election. So he didn't want to just come right out and say, we're going to have an election. My son's going to run and win, you know.
Mohammed, can I just make a point?
Yeah.
I mean, and here I like to hear from both Bruce and Ambassador Kennedy. I mean, the length of the Berdimuhamedov of the first presidency is the same as the Niyazov presidency, 15 years. But the amount of power that Berdimuhamedov Sr. has been able to amass, it's much larger than Niyazov. If we look just at the succession, I mean, Niyazov was never able to impose any candidate on a successor. Maybe they didn't want to. But whereas we now have a president who came out of nowhere, I mean, the margins of the elite. I mean, only nerds like me would know who Berdimuhamedov was before becoming the president. Mm-hmm. And in 15 years, he moved from the periphery to the very center of the elite, placing himself as someone so powerful that can impose on a number of elite members that have been there even for longer than him, candidature of his son, an inexperienced, by any account, not very bright, as the next president. I mean, how do Bruce and the ambassador explain this incredible rise of Berdimuhamedov?
Interesting.
Well, that's a fascinating question. I would just make one point in that I don't think that Niyazov failed at choosing his successor. I don't think he wanted to. I mean, if you look, of course, at his whole mode of operating, he consistently, you know, if somebody else was getting, you know, too much power or something, they got cut down. He was constantly, I think, alert to the possibility of somebody amassing too much power and then challenging him. And he eschewed completely, I think, any thought of trying to bring in his family behind him. I think he fully intended to stay in power until he died, as he did. But, I mean, you do raise a very crucial question, is what is it that allowed Berdimuhamedov to get to this stage? We'll see.
Yeah, these are very important geopolitical questions. In the meantime, we have Ruslan Matiyev joining us in the conversation. Very good to have you, Ruslan. We are talking about the discussion about the power succession in Turkmenistan apparently underway from father to son, as earlier Ambassador Kennedy pointed out. If this happens the way it is planned, it's going to be the first, even in Central Asia. So the local reaction to this development, what people are talking about?
Well, I should say that people inside the country are not very optimistic, unfortunately, because they know that Serdar has built his political career under his father. He was in his cabinet. He had different positions in the government. And most importantly, the fact is that his father is still alive. He won't be changing things drastically. He won't be introducing reforms or, you know, big changes, simply because it would otherwise undermine his father's policies, basically. However, I should note here that there is still hope, because Serdar is a young leader. And, let's acknowledge he's a leader. And there's no doubt that it would be him taking that position in the coming elections. People think that the fact that he has seen the world, even for a short time, even let's say under control, under supervision of more senior diplomats, he still saw the world. He saw how, you know, people live in other countries and how other countries function, actually. So in order to gain that support, electoral support, popular support, he will have to do something. He will have to introduce some sort of reforms, even cosmetic ones. Perhaps they will be, you know, in the first months of his rule, and then to tighten that grip again, just to tighten that grip again. But we compare the situation in Turkmenistan, the current situation in Turkmenistan, as the boiling pot, and he really needs to open up the lid a little bit, because otherwise we don't know what's going to happen. The society is very tired of his father's rule. It's a desperate situation for people. For more than 2 years now, borders are closed. People cannot go in. People cannot go out unless you are a family member of the president. Jobs are very few. Economic conditions of the country are bad. It feels as if the state does not care. We saw the devastating hurricane in 2020 and the reaction, in fact, the absence of reaction of the central government. You know, no help was provided. And this all tires people. You know, people are very tired of his father's rule. And there is very little hope that Serdar would be slightly better. He would, you know, loosen that grip a little bit, perhaps in the first months of his rule. So this is the general feelings in Turkmenistan. People are very apolitical. They think, we don't talk about politics. We don't think about politics. We cannot change things. It's all decided without us. These are the thoughts that are now in Ashgabat and elsewhere in Turkmenistan.
What you are saying, Ruslan, is that he might be his father's son, but the situation will force him to take some actions to ease what you described as the boiling pot in the country. In the meantime, I'm thinking from a different perspective, how you take those actions without putting the father, Berdi Muhammad, upon a bad light? Because as we all know, the majority of the troubles that people are currently in the country, it's because of his father's wrong policy decisions. So whatever action you take will certainly question his father's administration. According to him, people were living under golden age in his time. So it's such a tricky situation that he is in on how you really navigate your way out of the situation. Maybe let's talk about this. And also, I want to talk about his leadership style, Berdi Muhammedov Sr.'s rule going forward in the country. And how does all this looks like from some of the regional capitals with stake in Turkmenistan? So let's continue the conversation talking about these and many other questions very shortly. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis podcast. I'm joined by Ambassador Laura Kennedy, former U.S. Ambassador to Turkmenistan, Ruslan Miatiev, the director of Turkmen News Portal, Dr. Lokan Çeşçi, the author of a book on Turkmenistan's foreign policy and a lecturer at the Glasgow University on Central Asia, Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. I'm Mohamed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, DC, and we are discussing the ongoing power succession or the leadership change in Turkmenistan. So let me start the point that earlier Ruslan was making, that Serdar has to show something to the people and has to show it immediately. I understand that, but my question was how you do it without undermining your father's legacy, who's still around. And it's kind of open question, so anyone can jump in here.
I can jump here, Muhammad, if you allow. When I talked about changes and those cosmetic reforms, I didn't mean something grandiose, something big. It could be as simple as reopening borders, you know, and giving a reason that, okay, almost the entire population of Turkmenistan has been vaccinated. In fact, almost the entire world has been vaccinated, so there's no need, you know, to keep the borders so closed at the moment. So he reopens it. It can be as minimal as, for example, allowing the residents of Lebap and Dashoguz regions to travel to Uzbekistan on a visa-free policy for 3 or 5 days, and similarly allowing the residents of the Uzbek Bukhara region and the Khwarezm region to travel, visit Dashoguz and Lebap respectively, you know, on a visa-free policy. This will be already a huge relief for Turkmens, and both actually for Uzbeks too, because, you know, they have relatives on the other side of the border. So, and I mean, this is not very difficult for him to do. And as I said, he can always find a reason for that. Like, COVID is not a global problem, is not, you know, a killing virus anymore. We have vaccinated our society. Almost the entire world is vaccinated. So we're opening up. These are those small things that will make the society happy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he'll receive support. And he will gain political scores.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are talking about Turkmenistan, so we have to keep the bar very, very low. But under current circumstances, will these kind of, you know, minimal changes that Ruslan is talking about will be acceptable for people?
I agree that opening the borders would help out a lot in letting people cross into some of these other countries. But I would suggest that it can be something as simple as having the bazaar stocked with food for a few months. It's sad to think, but I mean, that the situation has gotten to be so bad in Turkmenistan, people lining up to get bread, and they're already out there at 3-4 in the morning or something. He would just open the government coffers a little bit and make sure that there was all kinds of imported foods or whatever, wheat, flour, all kinds of things like that for a few months, I think that would be enough to satisfy most Turkmen. It's sad to think that it's come to that, but I really think that that would probably be the easiest solution he could find, is just to make food available for a half a year.
But it is not going to change the misery that Turkmen people are for years now. I mean, it's not a solution for their problem, of course.
No, I was just going to jump in and second what's been said about those short-term gestures, and very much, these economic ones and the borders. I was back in Turkmenistan, I guess the last time in 2019, and I had been there the previous year. And when I traveled this time, I did it across land borders. When I was a diplomat, I would just fly between different places. And it was striking under, the new government, new president in Uzbekistan, how they had changed the borders. I mean, it was almost as if they had sent their border guards to charm school, whereas it was the same misery I witnessed personally for, Turkmen, families, who were visiting, relatives across the border, just how miserable an experience it was, let alone these last couple of years when things have been really sealed up tight. So I think that would make a big difference. And as Bruce was saying, just food, the basic, maybe I have no idea what the budget is these days, but restoring some of the subsidies that had been cut. I mean, those subsidies in the old days, certainly not a lot, but certainly were a benefit. But I would hope that there would be, some other at least modest things done. I mean, just as when Berdi Muhammadov first came into office, there was in the first, 6 months, maybe a whole raft of things that he instituted. But I don't look for any, huge wave of political reforms. As has been noticed, you always have to temper your expectations.
But can he afford, Ambassador, can he afford not doing those kind of changes, like a kind of a long-lasting challenge? I mean, it's been such a long time in Turkmenistan that people are living in this misery, but can he afford not to do those changes?
Well, I mean, who knows? But I would think, indeed, in what would be a very new phenomenon, i.e. the handing down power within the family would be the first time. So I think there'd be a particular burden on him to demonstrate that this departure from previous governance patterns, there's something in it for the long-suffering Turkmen people.
Mohammed, do you mind if I interject here?
Sure.
Yeah, of course he can get away with that. I mean, I don't think that we need to underestimate the impact of 2 years of border closures and isolation. I mean, we see that around the world, that the politics of COVID had made every kind of political landscape more authoritarian. He can get away with doing nothing, I would say, because if they manage to keep this news about Turkmenistan have no COVID for 2 years, we know it's been contested, but that's a line, it's been unchanged. Even the WHO is not contested, they can get away with everything. So on the one hand, I agree with the Ambassador Ambrose that the expectation has to be low. But at the same time, I wouldn't want to repeat the same thing that we saw, 15 years ago when Berdi Muhammadov work came in and we had people who published op-eds saying, oh, that's the Turkmen Spring and stuff like that. We need to be realistic. This is the perpetration, the continuation of one of the world's most authoritarian regimes. So even if the expectations are low, we will still have to call it for what it is. And to my mind, change is going to be very, very little and possibly as cosmetic as Ruslan was saying, which is a short-term solution. But in the long term, we will see the problems that we have with the economy, the problem with the politics, the society is being as from as it is returning, because obviously this regime cannot be the solution to the problem that they themselves have created.
You know, we remember, like, when his father, the present Berdimuhamedov, when he came to power, like, 15 years ago, you know, he was doing certain stuff like replacing the names of days and months and also expanding the higher school education from 9 to 12 years. Even this minimal kind of steps have created hope. Among my own colleagues, for example, they have their families in Turkmenistan, the hope that they might be able to go back and forth to the country. But what turned out to be just even more disastrous era under Berdimuhamedov. But what I'm saying is, like, we are sort of comparing the situation between now and 15 years ago. People in Turkmenistan must have changed. I don't think these minimal gesture would satisfy people. Maybe I'm just thinking differently here. I don't know, but it just times have changed, people have changed, and their miseries have doubled. People could see through these minimal expectations that we are laying out is not the real solution for the problem this country is facing. They could see it, right?
What remained, Muhammad, are the security services and the methods they apply and use against dissent, against that type of thinking. I interact with very many Turkmens, especially those who study abroad at the moment in Belarus, let's say in Ukraine or Russia. They are very open, they are very brave, they are very free thinking when they are in those countries. When they return to Turkmenistan, they change, they become the real Turkmen, like the Turkmen. Yes. So, yes, I mean, the whole an entire generation has grown within these 15 days of Berdimuhamedov Senior's rule. But the practice, the local conditions in Turkmenistan, they remain the same. Yes, I don't know, tens of thousands of students have received their higher education abroad. Some stayed in those countries. The vast majority has returned to Turkmenistan, but they return to the place that they know very well. They know the local rules. And if they break those rules, they can end up in trouble. And people do end up in trouble. We see activists, or let's say individuals, getting prison terms for commenting on Facebook or for creating poem on coronavirus and the tough life and publishing that on YouTube. People get real prison sentences for that. So expectations, whatever you have and feel inside, is one thing. But when you come down to reality, it's different. And though all those feelings, positive feelings, expectations and hopes, they become less important. You know, when at stake is your freedom and your life, probably you forget about the big things and big desires. There are two things I wanted to mention also. Serdar Berdimuhamedov is coming in a very interesting time. It's the time when last year, if I'm not mistaken, Turkmenistan has reported that it paid out the Chinese loan, basically, and that they are even now. I'm also thinking about the energy prices at the moment, the world prices for gas, natural gas, for example, yes, and the Chinese plan to build that fourth thread of pipeline from Turkmenistan. We have seen in the last few weeks probably some positive changes in that sense. Like, for example, the dollar rate, the unofficial, the market, black market dollar rate has dropped a little bit. Today it's somewhere around 18 manats per dollar, while a few months back it was close to 23, 25. Yes, we are seeing now the drop in prices for vegetable oil, the most important grocery probably in Turkmenistan. And people report that there are fewer troubles with getting flour, yes, to bake bread, etc. So these positive economic changes, yes, could play for the benefit of Serdar. Well, let's admit the majority of Turkmen society is not, you know, very much educated. They look at things. They look at sequence of events. They see, okay, Serdar came, prices have dropped, and they make that connection.
Yeah.
While it is, you know, there is a global picture. There is a global market. There is the fact that Turkmenistan has paid out that Chinese loan, etc. And the second thing about can Serdar get away without making reforms, I should note here that the entire surrounding is the same in Turkmenistan. It's those advisors who were the advisors of Sapar Murat Niyazov even. You know, they advised to Berdimuhamedov Sr. And these men are still around. There is still around Rashid Meredov, one of the longest serving Turkmen politicians. I'm sure he played one of the key roles during the power change in back in 2006/2007. And this man is still around. By the way, we hear from sources that he would be sent on pension once Serdar steps in, and that one of his deputies or the Turkmenistan's permanent representative in Geneva will take the position of Turkmenistan's foreign minister. So these people, the old advisors and the serving politicians, all the serving politicians are still around, and they will be around Serdar too. So
And also his father seems to be staying around. Bruce, earlier we were talking about that. What's the rule he's crafting out for himself going forward?
Well, he mentioned that he wants to head that People's Council. I don't think, you know, seeing Berdimuhamedov on television, seeing how he likes himself, how he likes this attitude towards himself, I don't believe that this is his like dream job, that he dreamed about it his entire life, you know, being the head of the People's Council, you know, working with the elderly, etc. I strongly believe that this entire decision of power transfer was dictated by his poor health state. He's simply not confident that he would be around for the coming 2 years until the regular, the following, or the planned elections, presidential elections in 2024. That's why he wanted to secure both Serdar's future and his future as the second president of Turkmenistan.
Let's see how secured Serdar's future in his future. Time will show, obviously. So, Bruce, how do you see how Berdimuhamedov's presence in some way or the other will factor in the way things will shape up under Serdar's administration?
Well, it certainly makes reforms a lot harder to imagine. You know, he's going to be looking over Serdar's shoulder all the time, I would imagine. You know, and it's strange. It sets up a situation kind of like Nazarbayev and Tokayev, but even more close, you know, where he's not Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov is no longer the president. But in fact, I mean, as head of the Halk Maslahati, the People's Council, he still has huge powers, you know, and you got to think that he's really going to be the one that's making all the important decisions in the country. You know, it'll be his son that comes in front of the public and announces them. But I got to believe that most of the policies of Turkmenistan will continue to be Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov's policies.
It's depressing. One also, you know, we are talking like if Serdar is going to be elected. Of course, we have no doubt that he will be. But in the meantime, authorities are also saying that there will be more candidates. You know, our Turkmen service was reporting about the deputy governor of Mari province joining the race as the candidate of the Agrarian Party. I guess it's an old movie, but nevertheless, I just wanted to mention that. And also, there are a couple of opposition members in exile discussing the possibility of organizing online elections. I guess it's also sort of a natural kind of reaction to this situation. And then earlier, Ruslan kind of brought up this. I mean, maybe Dr. Luka, you could jump in. I mean, yes, this is how it looks like when you look into these possible changes on top leadership, among top leadership in Turkmenistan. You know, there are countries, like earlier Ruslan was talking about China, for example. There are countries outside of Turkmenistan that might be looking into this with great interest, like Moscow, Ankara, or maybe Beijing. When they look into what is happening in Turkmenistan, what they see happening?
Well, I am not sure what kind of calculations are made in Beijing or in Moscow about what's happening in Ashgabat. I mean, obviously, continuity is the key word here. We have a president that's got the same surname as the prior president. It couldn't be more continuous than that, more stable than that. So also, I mean, here there is an underpinning problem, is that all the policies are going to be replicated and they're going to be reapplied for the next 20 years. And from China's perspective, that's fantastic because they're going to get more gas, or they're going to keep getting gas. So I would say that's the calculation that matters. I don't think that that Putin is paying too much attention. I mean, of course, he would be a bit informed about it, but he's got a lot of problems at the moment. And the other scene, Central Asia, well, I think that the most interesting observations now probably are made in a place like Dushanbe, where the president has got Assam that wants to promote. And if this model works, because, you know, these dictators copy each other all the time, you know, a process that we call authoritarian learning, is that probably they will see what happened and what and how it works in Turkmenistan in this context and how they can replicate it in Tajikistan when the time comes. But in general terms, everyone across the world really understand this as a decision that ensures continuity. I mean, we who've been observing this for a long time, we all agree that there's not going to be change. And if there is change, it's going to be not very meaningful. So you can imagine, you know, that the people who support the continuity in Turkmenistan, in Moscow, Beijing, or Ankara are happy with this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's also almost the time that when we wrap up the conversation. Is there anything that I missed raising in this conversation that you would like to bring up?
I could jump in real quick. I mean, you kind of touched on it a minute ago, but the actual campaign and race. You know, we've seen the facade, and not just in Turkmenistan before, but you throw up a bunch of candidates there and try to make it look like it's a real competition. But this is like the worst yet, as far as I can see. I mean, you know, you mentioned Agajan Bekmirodov, right?
Yeah.
He's the candidate in the Agrarian Party. I never saw such an unhappy-looking person in my whole life. Yeah. You know, and they got all these photos of him as being the candidate. And now, but what about the Party of Industrialists and Entrepreneurs? They don't even have a candidate. I'm wondering if all the top officials ran off into the desert so they, you know, one of them wouldn't have to be forced to go up there and compete, because we know in Turkmenistan, when you run against the president, you vanish from, I mean, not that these people are known anyway, but I mean, a lot of them after the elections fell on really hard times, you know, and that's it. But that, you know, like I said, Bekmirodov's face and all those pictures of, like, here's the Agrarian Party candidate really just said it all for me about this election. He was so unhappy in that picture, you know, and that just shows what a sham these elections are.
Well, Mohammed, do you mind if I ask a question to the panel? Because I have a question for anyone who can answer that. Do we know whether there have been some kind of fragmentation within the elite about Sertar's nomination? Is this going to be, I mean, of course, it's going to be a coronation, but do we know if someone had been unhappy along the way about the way in which the transition has gone?
Ambassador Kennedy might be in a position to talk about this.
Well, let me sort of flip it in the sense that no matter how much, you know, power the president amasses, I think part of the, you know, the rule is, you know, you bring along, you know, your sort of ruling elite. I mean, for Niyazov, it was a combination of, if somebody was getting too powerful, you constantly kept them in line, but you also had positive inducements in terms of, you know, getting some access to, you know, money or whatever. So I think they probably had some sort of an elite consensus when Berdy Muhammedov succeeded. And again, it's not any huge surprise that he's been aiming at this. So presumably sort of the elite more or less knew what was coming and has acquiesced in some fashion. Whether they're happy about it or not is a different issue. But, you know, going back to you know, sort of North Korea, where we've now had three generations. I remember when I was back in 2014, and I think it was Day of the Horse or something, so we were all out at the Hippodrome, and they were, you know, handing out prizes for this or that, and of the sort of the special category for the young upcoming horseman, guess who got the prize? It was Serdar's son. So sometimes they think, oh my gosh. You know, are we really looking at a dynasty? But I think there probably is some sort of, you know, elite buy-in to this. Now, somebody mentioned Muhammedov. My sense in him, who I think is about as hardworking an individual as I've ever met, and has indeed stayed in office through all these years when, you know, successive people have been taken down a peg. And I think one of the reasons he stayed is not only he speaks English, he knows the outside world, works like a dog, just a really dedicated guy. But I think he's been very careful, one, to have a careful lane. He does foreign policy, certain other things. Doesn't get involved, I think, with the, you know, the intel, the security services. I mean, that's sort of a way of I think, in a way, protecting yourself. So I see him as more of a apolitical is probably the wrong word in this context, but somebody who's, as I say, carved out a very careful role for himself. On the other hand, Tokayev, look at Tokayev in Nazarbayev. Again, very eminent statesman. Didn't have a power base, didn't have political ties, distinguished diplomat throughout his career, whom I think was specifically chosen to be sort of the heir precisely because he wouldn't be a political contender. But guess what? He's now, in a way, flexing his powers a bit as president. So who knows what the future may hold for Muratov, but I really do have to give him credit for being a a long-term servant who's managed to stay out of trouble and work very hard at carrying out Turkmenistan's foreign policy. Not an easy job under any circumstances.
You know, it's also sort of maybe I'm way ahead of our time now when I talk about this, like Berdimuhamedov was, you know, grooming this guy to be in the position that he wants him to be in a month's time. And then we already have a third star rising in Turkmenistan, his grandson. I just don't know how these things looks like when you are a Turkmen citizen in Turkmenistan, you know, this lineup of what comes next. I don't know. Let's see where we are headed with this. Maybe, Bruce, let's end the conversation with your final thoughts here. So where your eyes are going to be to determine where we are headed after this stage?
Well, you know, that's so tough because this is just an exercise. We're going to see a transfer of power, but the whole thing's already been planned out and scripted. And I don't see there's going to be, you know, I suppose the big thing would be to see if he does anything to try to endear himself to the people. I don't think it'll work. I think one so skeptical that probably won't, but if he actually tries to, you know, like I said, make food available or something to show there's some difference. But, I think this is, if I was a Turkmen citizen, I would be so depressed at this point, realizing that nothing was going to change, as we've heard from this conversation. The same government that's run the country into the ground is now about to be prolonged in power. This is not a happy occasion, you know, for anyone outside the Berdimuhamedov family and the ruling elite in the country. So I suppose the only thing I'd be looking at now is what happens in Tajikistan after this is done. You know, are they going to go, there we go, precedent is set and let's move forward? But that's all I can think of.
Okay. Yeah, this is not really a point that where we would like to end the conversation, but I guess this is the reality what we are dealing with in the country in Turkmenistan. So let's see, we have 20 more days to go before the election. So with this, we have to unfortunately conclude the conversation here, but we will keep our eyes open to what comes next in the country until the election and after the election. With this, thank you very much, Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. And also big thanks to Ambassador Laura Kennedy, former U.S. Ambassador to Turkmenistan, Ruslan Matiev, the director of Turkmen News Portal, Dr. Loka Ancheschi, the author of a book on Turkmenistan's foreign policy and a lecturer at the Glasgow University on Central Asia. Thank you very much, colleagues, for joining us today. And this is from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. Until next week, bye-bye.